I'm Mark Golub, and in the news, political vitriol on the American scene that has spilled over into the American Jewish community as well. There are many, many American Jews who believe Donald Trump has absolutely no business ever being president of the United States, and who literally detest the man. And they're prepared to say the most vile things about him and his presidency. And in the Jewish community, there's nothing worse than being likened to a Nazi. Recently, during an interview on MSNBC, Democratic nominee for president Joe Biden compared Donald Trump's rhetoric to that of Joseph Goebbels, the Nazi propagandist responsible for the rise of Hitler and the ensuing Holocaust. Professor Deborah Lipstadt, one of the Jewish community's leading academic authorities when it comes to the Holocaust, affirmed Mr. Biden's comments. Lipstadt tweeted, "Had VP Biden or anyone else compared Trump to what Hitler, Himmler, Heydrich, or Eichmann did, he would have been wrong. But a comparison to the master of the big lie, Joseph Goebbels, that's historically apt. It's all about historical nuance." Well, this demonization of President Trump has become commonplace in the American Jewish community, which has a long history, ever since FDR, of being committed to the Democratic Party. More than 70% of American Jews tend to vote for the Democratic candidate in presidential elections because they believe the Democratic Party best represents the values, the social values, which are very dear to American Jews. But when it comes to Donald Trump, the absolute hatred of the man far exceeds Jewish criticism for any prior Republican candidate for president. And there are many JBS viewers who've sent me emails calling Trump a Nazi. Well, how appropriate or inappropriate is it to liken Donald Trump to Joseph Goebbels or any Nazi, for that matter? And what does this vitriol all mean? For some answers, I am most pleased to be joined once again by a man who's been a victim of Jewish hatred for Donald Trump. He's Harvard Law Professor Emeritus and the author of Guilt by Accusation, and he has a new podcast of his own. We'll tell you about that in a minute. And he has, for well over 50 years, been a leading champion in the fields of civil and human rights in America, and he is the most articulate defender of the State of Israel, Alan Dershowitz. Alan, thank you so much for joining us again.
Well, thank you. You know, it really pains me to have to come on your show and criticize my dear friend, Deborah Lipstadt, because I love Deborah. She's fantastic. You know, we grew up not exactly together, but the same background, same summer camp, same, you know, yeshiva background. I've read all of her books. I wrote an introduction or a conclusion to one of her books. I'm a tremendous admirer.
She is a fantastic scholar and person.
But she's wrong about this one. You just don't go around comparing any president of the United States to anybody who was in any way connected to Nazi Germany. You may disagree with what President Trump has done and said. I certainly have. I didn't vote for him. I voted for Hillary Clinton. I was a strong liberal Democrat. I've never voted for a Republican for president in my life. But I have met with President Trump on numerous occasions. I did represent him in his impeachment matter, but I also helped represent Bill Clinton in his impeachment matter, and I would have represented Hillary Clinton had she been elected and impeached. I did it because I put the Constitution above politics. But the idea of calling our president by a name in any way related to Nazism just diminishes the memory of the Holocaust, makes false comparisons. Nothing should ever be compared to the Holocaust. You know, you want to compare him to other authoritarian leaders throughout history. There are many you can make comparisons to. I would probably disagree with most of those as well, but you don't get to Nazism. You don't get to anything relating to Goebbels or Goering or any of those people. It's just wrong. And we're seeing it more and more. We're seeing it with Netanyahu. I've heard Israelis compare Netanyahu to some people on the Nazi side.
Yes.
Look, I have sat with President Trump and talked to him about the Middle East peace plan. He loves Israel. He cares deeply about the Jewish community. I helped the White House not only with the peace plan, but also in a small way with the executive order that prohibits colleges and universities that receive federal funding from not protecting Jews against anti-Semitism. His heart's in the right place when it comes to Israel and Jewish values. You couldn't say that about Goebbels or Goering or any of those other people. And I just think it shows how divided we are as a country. It's just awful. And most of the people who won't talk to me because I stood up on the floor of the Senate and opposed President Trump's impeachment, most of the people who won't speak to me are Jewish. You know, when I've sat with President Trump, he has an occasion asked me, he said to me, he asked me a few times directly, why aren't more Jews supportive of me? I've been so good on Israel. And I had to explain to him, and I did. Look, Jews, like every other ethnic group in America, are deeply divided. Priorities are changing. You know, Jews feel very secure. Israel has become more secure. Israel and Jewish values aren't at the top of the Jewish agenda for many Jews. They care more about a woman's right to choose abortion. They care about gay rights. They care about gun control. They care about health care. They care about the type of language that's used by a president. And they're opposed to many of your policies, and therefore they can't see straight when it comes to Israel. Let me give you a perfect example. If President Obama had moved the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, as he promised to do, 95% of the Jewish community would have supported that move. But because President Trump did it, a large percentage of the Jewish community opposed that move. To his credit, Vice President Biden has said he would not reverse that move because every Democratic president has promised to do it. The same is true of the Golan Heights. The same is true of the amazing work that was done in helping to create normalcy between some of the Emirates and Israel. Great accomplishment that my friend Bill Clinton couldn't do. He tried, and my former, you know, Harvard student, not my student, but a student at Harvard Law School, Barack Obama couldn't do, but President Trump did it, and it's an amazing accomplishment. Look, the most credit for it goes to Israel. Israel has become such a strong country economically, technologically, environmentally, politically, diplomatically, that it's become clear to the Sunni Gulf states that they're better off siding with Israel than with Iran or Turkey. It's to Israel's credit, but it was President Trump who brought it about. And I'm not going to tell you who I'm voting for. That's my right to keep that confidential, and I plan to. But I can tell you that I appreciate very much what President Trump did for Israel and for the Jewish people. And I don't appreciate what Barack Obama did, even though I voted for him twice. To me, bipartisan means you attack the president you voted for when he does the wrong thing, which Obama did on the Iran deal and on the UN Security Council resolution condemning Israel's occupation of the Kotel, of the Western Wall, and of Hebrew University and Hadassah Hospital access roads. I was critical of that, and I'm supportive of the person I voted against when he ran against Hillary Clinton. And so that, for me, is bipartisan, and I would hope Jews would introduce a little bit of nuance, particularly my friend who are asking for nuance. Deborah, you're asking for nuance. I think we can expect a little bit more nuance from you on these issues. Explain that you disagree with President Trump. Explain all the things that are negative, but acknowledge, as I'm sure you do, the good things he's done for the Jewish people and for Israel, and don't make those kinds of comparisons, which are bad for America, are bad for survivors of the Holocaust. Deborah Lipson is a good person. She is a good, decent person. She, I think, simply got carried away and made a mistake on this one. I hope she will forgive me for saying that, but I always speak the truth.
And you say it very gently. I could not agree with you more, and I appreciate, again, the courage with which you speak. You know, it's not just that Trump has been good for Israel, and there are many, many things he's done, the ultimate being the deal between the UAE and Israel, which everybody said was impossible. And lo and behold, now we have it, and you've referenced it. And you also referenced Title VI, which right. Most American Jews don't even understand. Also, Alan, if you remember, I don't remember any other president condemning anti-Semitism in a State of the Union speech. And not this last speech, but the speech before it, when anti-Semitism was in the forefront of the news, President Trump, in the State of the Union, speaks out strongly about anti-Semitism, and then, as you point out, he adds anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic behavior, Title VI. These are things that affect us as American Jews, let alone Israel. But I don't hear American Jews in general, those who oppose Trump with, again, an emotional fervor that is almost religious in tone. Well, I don't hear them ever giving Trump credit for any of this.
And I also don't hear many of Jews on the liberal side, I think of myself on the liberal side, as condemning members of the Democratic Party who are anti-Semitic, like Ilhan Omar. And I wouldn't have said that about AOC until recently, but her refusal to appear at a left-wing, pro-peace memorial for Yitzhak Rabin was disgraceful. I mean, it really shows that she will have nothing to do with anybody who has a Zionist bone in their body or who supports Israel's right to exist. She and Peter Beinart make a wonderful couple these days. Peter Beinart doesn't believe that Israel should exist as the nation state of the Jewish people, but I suspect even he might go to a memorial service for Yitzhak Rabin, but he won't be accompanied by AOC. And I want to hear the Democrats condemn the anti-Semitism on their extreme left-wing fringe. I'm not for a moment suggesting, as some of my email suggests, that the Democratic Party is anti-Semitic. It's not. Or that Joe Biden is. He's not. Joe Biden is a friend of the Jewish people, as was Bill Clinton, a friend of the Jewish people. But Ilhan Omar is not a friend of the Jewish people, and AOC is no longer somebody who can be counted on as a friend of Israel. You know, when she first got elected, I said the Jewish community ought to reach out to her, particularly the left of the Jewish community, invite her to come to Israel, introduce her to left-wing Jews, introduce her to Peace Now, introduce her to, ACRI, Association for Civil Rights in Israel. Let her establish relations with the left in Israel. No more. She's gone beyond the pale of acceptability. She is now an enemy of Israel, an enemy of the Jewish people, an enemy of decency, and a friend of bigotry.
I'm not going to ask you who you're voting for because you've already made clear that's a private matter. It's not meant for public, not meant for JBS. But I imagine in some way you're between a rock and a hard place, as many long, long, long time Jews who've been loyal to the Democratic Party, have only voted Democrat, are now facing issues. And I don't know where you're going to come out, but it's not an easy decision for many Jews. Incidentally, Alan, if I'm not mistaken, you have been called a Nazi for having philosophically opposed politicizing the law, including impeachment, and for your agreeing to be part of the Trump legal team during the impeachment process. Is that true?
That's true. I've been called a Nazi. I've been called worse. People have attacked me. People have attacked my family. Somebody walked out of a gym that my wife was working out in Florida. And somebody said, that's Alan Dershowitz's wife. And the woman said, oh, I can't be in the same gym with the wife of somebody who would be married to Alan Dershowitz, who defended President Trump. Look, it's just McCarthyism. I grew up during McCarthyism. You're too young to remember McCarthyism.
I am not. I wish I were, but I was young. I was very, but I watched my parents glued to the TV during the McCarthy hearings.
I'll never forget. I signed a petition in favor of saving the lives of the Rosenbergs, and my parents thought my career was over. I was now on some blacklist, and I defended professors at Brooklyn College who were being fired for being Fifth Amendment communists. And the person who was behind some of the firings was a professor at Brooklyn College named Eugene Scalia, Justice Scalia's father. And I got to know Justice Scalia's father because we were on opposite sides of that issue. I was the president of the student government at Brooklyn College. I was the first Orthodox Jew to be president of the Brooklyn College student body. And I stood up against McCarthyism. And nonetheless, I admired Eugene Scalia, much the way I admired his son. We disagreed with so many things, and but I admired them as individuals and as human beings. Today, that just doesn't happen. If you disagree with somebody, you can't admire them. I get these emails all the time saying, I used to admire you, now I hate your guts. I write back, and I say, you should never have admired me. You don't understand me. You admired me because you thought I was on your side. I wasn't on your side. I was on the side of civil liberties, side of human rights, on the side of the Constitution. Now that the Constitution and human rights and civil liberties comes down on a different side, you don't admire me. You're not wrong for not admiring me now. You're wrong for ever having admired me. You never should have because you never understood me. But I get those letters all the time.
By the way, Alan Dershowitz has been a champion of civil rights and human rights for more than 50 years. And you heard me say it's known. There has never been as articulate and as emotionally committed defender of Israel in America than you. Well, boggle your mind that Jews now have made you into this enemy?
Yeah, I mean, look at 92nd Street Y. I spoke there more than anybody else other than Elie Wiesel. I was their yearly speaker. I always spoke. Now they've canceled me and they banned me. And I have to tell you, if Elie Wiesel were alive today, he wouldn't set foot in the 92nd Street Y. He would never tolerate canceling me and banning me. The last time I tried to speak there was on my book, Defending Israel, which I wanted to see as a book on college campuses, making a defense for Israel. The 92nd Street Y wouldn't allow me to speak on defense of Israel. And I would hope that people would stop attending 92nd Street Y events in protest for their refusal to allow a speaker on behalf of Israel like me to speak. They will allow terrorists to speak. They will allow anti-Israel speakers. They'll certainly invite Peter Beinart, who doesn't believe in Israel's right to exist. They probably would invite AOC to speak, but they won't invite Alan Dershowitz to speak from the podium of the 92nd Street Y.
Yes.
It is a scandal, and it shows so much about the way in which hatred within the Jewish community can manifest itself, even by organizations like the 92nd Street Y. I wish I had never, ever spoken at the 92nd Street Y.
It was a different why. By the way, do you know why they won't let you speak? Your face or your ear a reason?
No. And they have said to somebody who asked to have me speak, we don't believe any of these false accusations against Dershowitz, but he's trouble. If he were to speak, there'd be protests. Well, yeah, maybe there would be. That's the role of a First Amendment free speech organization. Everywhere I speak, there are protests. Mostly there are protests because I'm pro-Israel. People don't want to hear a pro-Israel speaker on university campuses. That I understand. But for the 92nd Street Y to refuse to hear a speaker. I have to tell you, you know, they constantly do invite prime ministers of Israel. I will tell my friend Benjamin Netanyahu, I don't think you should speak at the 92nd Street Y if they have rules that prohibit a pro-Israel speaker like me from speaking at the 92nd Street Y. They have lost their credibility as a neutral platform for speakers. I know that you used to, maybe you still do, broadcast some of the 92nd Street Y speeches. I know you broadcast some of mine, but no longer will they allow me to speak on the premises of the 92nd Street Y.
Boy, has it gotten any better for you over this last half a year or so?
And no.
Do you say no?
No, it's gotten worse, if anything. Yeah. It's not gotten any better. It's gotten worse because of the election season we're in. You know, people think that I'm the reason that Donald Trump is president of the United States. I wish I had that power. I don't. I only made an argument that I would as a lawyer against his impeachment. But today the hatred is more than it ever was and will continue. I don't see any end to this division among the Jewish and within the Jewish community.
Changing gears for a moment, I'm particularly glad to have a chance to speak to you right now during the Senate Judiciary's Committee interviewing Amy Coney Barrett for her nomination to become the next member of the Supreme Court. There is no one on the American scene who knows this system better. The process itself, Alan, is fascinating, and it's raised a number of important philosophical issues regarding the proper role of a Supreme Court justice. I'd love to hear you speak about. First of all, have you ever met Judge Barrett? What do you think of her as a potential Supreme Court justice?
I've never met her, to my knowledge. I've read her articles. She's highly qualified. There's no doubt she's as qualified as Justice Scalia was, or as Justice Ginsburg was, or any of the other justices. She's highly, highly qualified. The two issues have nothing to do with her qualification. One, should the Republicans allow a nomination to go forward just 2.5 weeks by the time they nominate her out of the committee, it'll be just a week and a half before an election, after they stopped a prior nomination from President Obama of Merrick Garland, who many people don't know, too, was not only a great jurist, a great justice, but also Jewish by background and heritage. He was kept off the Supreme Court by Republicans who said, you don't allow a confirmation process to go through 8 months before the election. Now it's 3 weeks, and they're hypocritically adopting a different standard. So that's one reason for
Hold that for 1 second. Are they any more hypocritical than Democrats who argue the exact opposite during Garland that they're arguing now?
No, of course, Democrats had a slightly better case. They were 8 months ahead, and this is only 3 weeks, but there's hypocrisy on both sides.
On
I have
both
no
sides.
Doubt.
Yeah,
I'm not
impressed with any of them.
And no, they both failed the shoe on the other foot test. So
exactly.
That's one issue.
I've learned that from you. Anybody who's been watching you on JBS should have learned that already. So when it comes to hypocrisy, pack, you know, on all their houses. But now what's the second issue you're going to raise?
The second issue is when you have a court that's so closely divided, 5-4 on so many issues, this will give Republican nominees and conservatives a very strong 5-4, sometimes 6-3 vote. Should that be done on the basis of a 51-49% majority? I think I was in favor of keeping the old rule, which permitted 41 senators to stop a nomination to the Supreme Court. That was changed first by Democrats, then by Republicans. Again, hypocrisy on both sides.
Right.
But now we have a situation where literally you could have a 50-50 vote, where let's assume Mitt Romney were to change his mind. I don't think he will. I don't understand why he hasn't, because he's been so independent. But if you had a 50-50 vote in the Senate, then you get a justice serving for 40 years without having a majority of the Senate, the vote being cast decidingly by the vice president, who was not generally a member of the United States Senate. So the question is, should you have lifetime appointments, 40-year terms on the Supreme Court? Should you have a simple majority? The Constitution made a mistake. They should have required 2/3 to be on the Supreme Court. Then we'd have candidates nominated who had to get the support of some people from the other party. You get much more moderate and centrist candidates. But look, we live in a world where it's now 50 can confirm. It can be done a day before the election. She can then sit on cases involving the Affordable Care Act and indeed possibly involving whether or not Trump wins or loses the presidency. It's going to hurt the credibility of the Supreme Court. This is a process that is increasing the politicization of the Supreme Court. It's already been increased. Again, it started with Bork. Bork was highly qualified to be on the Supreme Court, but he was borked and kept off the court. And then there was Thomas. And then a couple of years ago, there was Kavanaugh. And so we've had a lot of these now. And at least in this case, in the case of Barrett, nobody has questioned her integrity. Nobody has questioned her intelligence or seriousness. The only question are these outside questions. Should the Democrats apply the same standards that the Republicans applied? They would if they had the power to. They don't have the power to. And should a 40-year appointment be confirmed by a tie vote of the Senate or a 51-49 vote? Those are institutional questions, but they have nothing to do with her credibility or her integrity or her qualifications.
And I appreciate the fact that you've raised the issue of, do you want a justice who doesn't have a significant majority of the Senate voting for them? But at the moment, that's just not the system. It's not the system whether Democrats were in power or Republicans were in power. And again, based on the shoe on the other foot, it doesn't occur to me that if the Democrats were in the exact same position where they had the presidency and the Senate and there were 2 days left, they would absolutely want to get their person on the Supreme Court. So for me, there are a lot of issues here, but the political issues don't move me. I'll give you an example of an issue that I'd like you to speak to.
Sure.
Republicans are accusing Democrats of using the Supreme Court as a quasi-legislative body that will subvert the people's will.
Uh-huh.
Many Republicans are supporting Amy Coney Barrett because they believe she will vote, perhaps to overturn Obamacare. Perhaps she may vote against Roe v. Wade, even though in both of those instances, it seems that a majority of Americans support the Affordable Care Act and obviously support Roe v. Wade. So are the Republicans and Democrats equally guilty of trying to use the Supreme Court to further their political agenda, even if their goals conflict with the people's will?
Of course. And the shoe always is on the other foot. You're going to have now conservatives are going to become judicial activists. They're going to want more and more and more decisions by the Supreme Court. And liberals are going to become supporters of judicial restraint because they will take control probably of the presidency, the House, and the Senate. We're going to see everything flip-flop. And for example, I think one of the first things that if we get a Democratic control of both houses and the presidency, they will probably pass a national right to choose law saying that every woman in America has the right to choose abortion, certainly up to a certain number of months. The conservatives will then challenge them in the Supreme Court under the Commerce Clause. And we'll see whether an activist Supreme Court then strikes down the will of the people. Already we know that the activist Supreme Court on the conservative side was willing to strike down the will of the people on the Affordable Care Act. So we're going to see everything turned upside down, topsy-turvy. That's politics in America. We live in a country where hypocrisy doesn't take points away from you. It'd be interesting to see what happens in South Carolina. Lindsey Graham, I like very much as a person. He's a very nice man. He's been very supportive of Israel. But he's the one who said, use my words against me. If President Trump gets to make a nomination in the last year of his presidency, I, as chairman of the Judiciary Committee, will not allow it to go forward. He's allowed it to go forward. He's now in a very close election in South Carolina, where my family, my wife's family, is from. So we're following the election very closely. It'd be interesting to see whether the hypocrisy factor plays, whether it plays with the voters, because his opponent who's a very able African-American liberal, is pointing out the hypocrisy. We'll see if that works with voters or doesn't work with voters.
By the way, I'm going to say this again. It seems to me to be so simplistic. There is ample hypocrisy everywhere in sure. both parties. No one should doubt that if the shoe were not on the other foot, the mm-hmm. Democrats would have been doing the exact same thing. So to hold Lindsey Graham responsible, if that's his political crime, it seems to me to be silly. Now, I want to remind you, and you may not remember this. This goes back. You and I have been doing a lot of programming on right. JBS, even from the days it was Shalom TV.
Right.
You once told me that had you been on the Supreme Court when Roe v. Wade came to that court, you would not have supported Roe v. Wade, although you support absolutely a woman's right to abortion in America.
That's true. But you That's thought, true. I've written about that. Okay, I've written about that.
You thought yeah. Roe v. Wade was bad law. If Amy Barrett believes Roe v. Wade or Obamacare is bad law, even if she supports a woman's right to an abortion and believes people with health insurance should, that health insurance should cover medical preconditions, she believes in both, but she thinks the law is unconstitutional, is she not bound by her oath of office to rule not on what she'd like for people, but on the constitutionality of the law?
That won't be a problem for her because she doesn't like abortion as a matter of her own personal belief. So she would do that. But you've left out one important element, and that is precedent. The certainty of the law is the liberty of us all. And precedent is very, very important. And Roe versus Wade has been precedent for nearly half a century. And so I think any responsible justice would say, even if I initially would not have voted for Roe versus Wade, and I don't know how I would have voted had I been a justice, I don't think Roe versus Wade was very persuasive law. I can't find the right of abortion in the Constitution. It's certainly not in the right of privacy. The right of gay marriage is in the right of privacy because nobody's affected. If a man as marries another man, that doesn't affect anybody else's life. But if a fetus is in fact some viable pre-human, there is a conflict, and I don't see that that conflict is resolved by the Constitution. Having said that, I would not overrule Roe versus Wade. I would stay with it because it has become established super precedential law in my view. But and the same thing I think is true of the Affordable Care Act. Even though it's only a recently enacted law, it affects so many people that I would do what Justice John Roberts did. I would resolve doubts in favor of upholding the law, even if I thought it was somewhat questionable. If I were a justice of the Supreme Court, I'd be quite a conservative justice. I would actually not reverse a lot of legislative judgments. I would focus my attention on the poorest people, the people who have no access to the legal process, on people who can't vindicate their rights through the legislature or through the executive branch. That's what I think the appropriate function of the Supreme Court is. I would hope maybe that she agrees with that. She has been pretty good on due process and some of these other issues. So, you know, my hopes are that she, like other justices, will disappoint the president who appointed her, who nominated her, and move more to the center the way John Roberts did. But I'm not sure that will be the case. Justice Alito moved more to the right, away from the center. So you never know where
you
a justice
never know.
Is going to
come. But I believe you're right. And I believe, I don't believe anybody is going to permit the overturning of Roe v. Wade in America.
Well, there's another good reason why it won't happen. It would be the best thing that could ever happen to the Democratic Party. It would help the Democratic Party win elections all over the country because the vast majority of Americans favor a woman's right to choose. And by constitutionalizing it, I've written about this, by taking the issue away from the people and putting it in the courts, the Democratic Party hurt itself and created the right to life movement and created the powerful extreme religious right in this country. So it backfired politically as well as constitutionally. And that's why I think they'll never overrule Roe versus Wade, because it would guarantee that Democrats would win state after state after state because the vast majority of people want to give a woman a right to choose abortion, at least under certain circumstances.
By the way, I've never heard anybody say that. And when you say it, it's like, oh, of course. By the way, again, I want to come back to the process and the principle from your perspective. And in some way, you want the Supreme Court to be very sensitive to the reality of people's lives. Right. Alan, should the Supreme Court take the burden people must bear in the world into account when they rule on the constitutionality of a law, for example, Roe v. Wade or Obamacare? And to what extent does human need in some way factor into the legitimate concerns of a Supreme Court justice?
It's a very hard question. Take, for example, Brown versus Board of Education. I have absolutely no doubt that the framers of the 14th Amendment had not an inkling that it would ever be used to desegregate schools or permit a black person to marry a white person. They had no idea that that would be the meaning of equal protection. And if somebody told them that, they'd vote against it. They were not voting for integrated schools or integrated marriages. They were clearly against both of those. When by equal protection, they meant blatant discrimination in jobs and housing and other kinds of things. But we evolved as a country, and Brown versus Board of Education became inevitable, 9-0 in the Supreme Court. You just couldn't continue to live in an apartheid system where black children got inferior education to white children in all black schools. And so, yes, the needs of the people were taken into account. You can do that with equal protection because that's open-ended and broad. You can do it with due process. You can do it with cruel and unusual punishment. You can't do it with certain provisions of the Constitution, like the age limitation on presidents. Let's assume you have the most brilliant wartime man running for president or woman, and he or she was 29 years old, and everybody wanted that person to be president. That person couldn't be president. You can't change those words in the Constitution. But equal protection is a broad-based concept. Now we have a debate whether equal protection is consistent with race-based quotas or race-based affirmative action. That's an issue that will be coming before the court, and I suspect that the Supreme Court will strike down in the near future any use of race in deciding qualifications for public state admission to colleges. And private colleges will continue to be able to have affirmative action, but public colleges,
how do you feel about that?
Not.
What's your personal view?
I think in the end, America is built on meritocracy and equality. I support Martin Luther King when he said, I have a dream that someday my children will be judged by the quality of their character, not the color of their skin. That's the goal. That's the ideal that we move toward. I have another book coming out in about a month called Cancel Culture, The New Attack on Free Speech and Due Process, in which I also argue that cancel culture is an attack on meritocracy. And we're seeing a frontal attack on meritocracy. And so ultimately, whether it's this year, next year, 5 years from now, I want to see race blind admission to everything. I want to make sure that the Boston Symphony and the New York Philharmonic keep the screen up when they audition musicians and don't peek behind the screen to see if the person auditioning is the son or daughter of a major contributor or a person whose identity is supported by their desire for diversity. I want to make sure the best musicians play and they're picked based on just their musical skills, not whether they're the son or daughter of major contributors. And that's true of Harvard University as well. You know, 25 years ago, I urged that applications for Harvard eliminate two facts. Number one, your last name. So we wouldn't know your name. You would apply as Alan Morton. And they wouldn't know your last name, so they wouldn't know whether you were rich or poor. They wouldn't know. And they wouldn't know the school you went to, the high school you went to. They would know whether you went to a grade one school, two, three, four. But they wouldn't know whether it was some elite fancy prep school or something else. So that Harvard would only know the relevant facts and not be able to discriminate even if it wanted to. The answer to that, they say, is no, that couldn't be possible because then half of the student body would be Asian Americans. Well, too bad. That's fine. I'm happy with that. If the most qualified people to apply to universities today are Asian Americans, so be it. When I say too bad, I really mean too good. That would be a wonderful. And we now have lawsuits at Harvard, at Yale, and a number of other institutions claiming discrimination against Asian Americans. Look, I remember when there was overt discrimination against Jewish Americans, where Jews had to go to medical school in Europe because they couldn't get into medical schools in the United States, where Yale University had a quota, Harvard had a quota. Many of the best universities had quotas. And so I don't want to see quotas against Asian Americans either.
You know, at one point, what you're expressing is classical liberal values.
Sure.
But at the moment, liberals who are perhaps should be really identified as progressives, they disagree with you.
Well, they're not liberals. They're not liberals. They are radicals. They're not progressives. They're regressives. They don't believe in free speech or due process. I'm the liberal, and I'm not going to give up my liberalism. And there's a good article in today's or yesterday's this week tablet by Barry Weiss about that, how the new threat to the Jewish community is the end of traditional liberalism, which is where Jews have thrived. You know, Jews always thrive at the center. We are always the victims of extremes, the black between the black and the red. We have been the victims of fascism and the victims of communism. We have been the victims of socialism, even though Jews invented it. And so I think we're much better off when we move toward the center. Liberalism, conservatism, but centrism has been the key to Jewish success.
I haven't had a chance to ask you, and only because of some of the things you've said here, the question came to my mind. What's your sense of Black Lives Matter?
Well, I like the concept of Black Lives Matter, but I will have nothing to do with any organization that has in its platform singling out Israel and calling Israel an apartheid genocidal state. So please, Black Lives Matter, don't ask me for contributions or support or even acceptance of your platform. I accept the concept. Yes, Black Lives do matter. And yes, there's been too much police violence, and I will support and join other organizations. I've been fighting against police misconduct against blacks for 50 years for more. I went down south in the 1960s to protest that. But I will under no circumstances compromise with anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism and have anything but contempt for an organization that continues to have in its platform singling out one country, the nation state of the Jewish people, and accusing it of genocide and apartheid. So don't count on me for your support as long as you have that obnoxious anti-Semitic element in your platform.
By the way, is that the only thing that bothers you about Black Lives Matter?
I don't have to get to anything else because that bothers me so much that I don't have to reach any of the other issues. But I do not believe that America is systemically racist.
You do not? Wait a minute. You do not believe?
I do not believe that. I think we've improved enormously over the years. I think we've had a history of racism. I don't believe in defunding the police. I believe in increasing the funding for police so we can increase salaries, increase better training, give them better non-lethal weapons. So there's much in the Black Lives Matter platform with which I disagree, but I've been focusing primarily on the singling out of Israel. There's not a mention in the Black Lives platform about the Philippines where they murder, police murder innocent people, Syria, Iran, the Palestinian Authority, Hamas, Turkey, you name it, where there are real police abuses. You see nothing about that, only about Israel, the nation state of the Jewish people. The platform of Black Lives Matter is overtly anti-Semitic and cannot be accepted or tolerated by any decent person.
All right, you've already said that you support the Affordable Care Act.
Right.
And you believe it's very important that Roe v. Wade be the law of the land, even if it had problems when it first came.
Right.
Okay. And now it's very possible, it's overwhelmingly likely, as we're doing this taping, that Justice Barrett will become a member of the Supreme Court, and there will be, at least in theory, a 5-4 conservative-leaning Supreme Court. In that instance, would you support the Democrats enlarging the number of Supreme Court justices and do what is called packing the court.
I would not. I don't agree with that. I think that it will create a cycle where the Democrats would do it when they controlled, and the Republicans would come in and raise the number from 11 to 13, and then the Democrats will raise it from 13 to 15, and we get a Supreme Court that was packed and repacked in order to suit the ideology of the packers. So, no, I would not be in support of court packing, and I don't think Vice President Biden in the end would support it. Look, the temptation is great. The Republicans did, I think, steal a seat from the Democrats when they refused to process the Merrick Garland nomination. I think they should be rebuked for that. But I don't think the proper revenge is to be taken on the Supreme Court itself as an institution, and court packing would hurt the credibility of the Supreme Court.
Okay. Speak about the issue that has been raised during Judge Barrett's answers. We have heard over and over again that she is what is called an originalist. Alan, pretend we're in class for a moment. Explain to our audience what an originalist is and what the alternative to the originalist is.
Look, we're all originalists. We all look at the words of the Constitution. When it comes to age 35 for the president, I'm an originalist. I'm also an originalist when it comes to equal protection, but I believe equal protection, as Martin Luther King put it, was a promissory note given to the American public. It's an aspiration. Will we someday achieve equal protection? We hope so, but it's a broad, open-ended concept. But I am an originalist. I think you start out with the text of the Constitution. When I argued against impeachment on the floor of the United States Senate, I did it as an originalist. I went back and I looked at the debates. I looked at the terms of the Constitution, treason, bribery, other high crimes and misdemeanors. And I said, in that context, using the Talmudic method of interpretation that I learned as a yeshiva student, and any method of interpretation, when it says, or other high crimes and misdemeanors, it means things like treason and bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. That's an originalist approach. The Talmud has methods of interpretation. The common law has methods of interpretation. Justice Scalia once said, when you see words in parallel, when you see Michael Jordan, Muhammad Ali, and other great competitors, you don't think other great competitors mean Sam Walton. Other great competitors after Muhammad Ali and Michael Jordan mean other great athletic competitors. And so when you see a phrase in the Constitution that says treason, bribery, other high crimes and misdemeanors, other high crimes and misdemeanors mean things like treason and bribery, extortion, that kind of thing. They don't mean abuse of power or obstruction of Congress, which were never intended by the framers. So we're all originalists. The question is what you do with phrases like equal protection, due process, and cruel and unusual punishment, or other open-ended phrases. Those, in my mind, as an originalist, are invitations to interpretation that comport with contemporary values. I think the same thing is true when you interpret the Torah, when you interpret Jewish tradition. There are words that are clear and are not subject to any kind of interpretation. And remember, the Rambam didn't love interpretation. He thought there was a clear meaning in the Mishnah Torah. He didn't like the Talmud. Yet the Talmudic method of interpretation has been the one that has governed certainly Eastern European Ashkenazi Judaism for centuries and millennia. And so, yeah, I'm an originalist, but I'm an originalist with common sense.
When we hear her asked to discuss her philosophy, it seems to be that Democrats feel being an originalist, there's something bad about it. And that's why I said to you, if I had somebody from the Judiciary Committee here, and I said to this person, what's the alternative to an originalist? Because what you basically said is, the reality is everybody interprets the Constitution, but you're hoping they start with the words that are there. What is, I'm asking you again, is there another philosophy of reading and interpreting the Constitution that is used by a word other than originalist?
Sure. It's called, there are many. Justice Brennan, Justice Warren used different terms, a living Constitution.
Yes.
Justice Scalia mocked that all the time. He said, my constitution is a dead constitution. Well, mine is partly dead and partly living. 35 years old is dead. Due process is alive and well. Commerce Clause, we've seen, you know, major different interpretations of the Commerce Clause. I suspect the next case that's going to come up is going to be a congressional statute giving every woman in America the right to choose abortion up until a certain point in the pregnancy. And they're going to do it under the Commerce Clause. They're going to say that we live in a country now where people move across borders very quickly. We don't want to have a situation where a woman in Mississippi has to move to Ohio to have an abortion. So Congress's right to regulate interstate commerce includes the right to create a right for a woman to have an abortion in her home state under certain circumstances. And or the president may invoke his executive authority, saying any governmental unit that receives federal funding will have to accord the right to abortion. Now, will all the Democrats agree to that? No. There are going to be some Democrats from states with religious conservatives that will not want to see abortion. We're a very divided country when it comes to abortion. And then we may get to the nuclear issue. Let's assume that it goes back to the states and virtually every state allows a woman to choose abortion. We're going to get some justices, maybe Justice Barrett, I don't know, saying the Constitution has a right to life and a state doesn't even have the power to permit an abortion because an abortion means taking a life from a living fetus. So we may see that become an issue subject to constitutional debate. I think that would be as wrong as trying to find a right to abortion in the Constitution, trying to find a right to life in the Constitution. I do believe that there is a fundamental right of people to control their own body, but when it that means that a gay man can have sex with another gay man, but it doesn't naturally mean that a woman has the right to terminate her pregnancy because the fetus, if you believe it's an independent human being, has rights as well. So we're never going to see a clear resolution of that issue. It's going to continue through my lifetime and yours.
Okay. What about the Electoral College? Do you think it should be abolished?
I wish it could be abolished, but it can't. You can't tinker with the Constitution. You'll never get a majority of the states and the number of states that are required. We're stuck with the Electoral College. There is a tactic that's being suggested now to circumvent the Electoral College, and I don't think it'll work, but it's clever. And that is state by state, they're thinking about passing statutes in every state saying that all of our electors will go to the person who got the most votes in the national election. That would be very interesting. That is the state of Georgia, even though Georgia went overwhelmingly, say, Republican, if in fact the national election went overwhelmingly Democrat, all the Georgia electors under state law would have to cast their electoral votes for the Democrat. That would abolish the Electoral College in effect, but would it be upheld by the Supreme Court? That's a hard question.
Okay. Last question for you, issue. I want to know how you feel about the fact that Facebook, Twitter, YouTube has engaged in censoring material, normally material on the left. You have been censored. I was censored on YouTube, which took down a lecture I did on being an American Zionist. What's your sense of the power of these social media organizations to literally take things down, including things posted by the President of the United States?
Look, it's a double-edged sword. We all want to see Facebook and others have the power to take down instructions how to blow up a synagogue or advocacy and incitement of hatred of Jews or blacks or gays. We all would like to see them have the power to do that. But then we see they abuse their power and they take down they had to a marking. I made a speech for Dennis Prager's university in which I talked about Israel's legitimate birth certificate, how it came into being through legal means. They marked that as inappropriate for young people. I meant it for young people. That was exactly what my intended audience was. And that's now the subject of a lawsuit. This is going to be the great First Amendment issue of the rest of the 21st century. And we're seeing it playing out just now with the New York Post having its expose of Hunter Biden being taken down by social networks and complaints being leveled by some of the same people who would like to see censorship if the censorship went the other way. Again, it's the shoe on the other foot. Everybody wants to see censorship for thee, but not for me. And if I have my choice, I'd rather see no censorship at all. But if you're going to have standards, you have to apply them fairly.
Okay, so you're doing now the Der Show, which
That's
is
right.
a podcast.
Yeah.
You're doing it virtually every day, yes, Alan?
I'm doing it 5 days a week. I get up in the morning. I look at the newspapers. I say, what do I feel really strongly about this morning? My son is the producer. We're away on Martha's Vineyard in isolation. I have my little home studio. I do my show. I talk to myself for 15 or 20 minutes. Then I take calls. Starting next week, we're going to have guests. I think Megyn Kelly has agreed to be my first guest. We'll have guests from Israel. We'll have guests from American politics. But mostly, if you want to hear my nonpartisan, objective, shoe on the other foot views, that's the place to hear it, because you're not going to hear it at the 92nd Street Y. So if you want to hear my views, you're going to have to hear it on my own podcast. Thank God for podcasts. They can't censor those.
Yes. I'm thrilled for you. I'm thrilled you're doing it. I want to talk to you and your son about somehow maybe doing some of that on JBS. It would be wonderful to hear you talk to Megyn Kelly and people, you know, major people on the world scene who would talk to you, I know, anytime. Anyway,
well, you know how much I enjoy being on any program with you or on your network, so I'm happy to consider it. And thank you always for having me on and giving me an opportunity to speak to my friends in your audience, and even maybe some of the people who don't like me as much. Maybe if they hear my views, they'll understand that I'm really pretty objective and neutral in my analysis of current problems. So as I say at the end of my podcast every day, the one promise I make to you is I'll never bore you.
Well, it's not only you'll never bore us, we always learn from you, Alan. And I am so grateful that you make yourself available to JBS. I know what demand you're in. Even now, people are just always after you.
Right.
Sometimes because they're angry at you, but they're always after you. And somehow you find time for me and the JBS
I
audience.
I always do.
I wish you kol tov v'hatzlacha. We will talk again very, very soon. Thank you for this, Alan.
Be well. Thank you.
Be well. Alan Dershowitz, Emeritus Harvard Law Professor, author of Guilt by Accusation. Now he's doing his own podcast, Dershow, Dershow, but it's one word. I hope you found our discussion broadened your own understanding, even if you disagree with what Alan or I had to say. And I am always thrilled to have Alan on JBS. My thanks, as always, to our director, Sloan Copeland, to managing director, Dara Golub, to transmission manager, John McDevitt, and to the producer of In the News, Carol Lilienthal. Until the next time, I'm Mark Golub. Be well, my friends.